in a couple of months after this session is over. I don't live with the challenges and barriers that you folks do every day. And I need to hear that experience from you folks to be able to reflect to make sure we get it right for you.
Representative Katie Jones from District 61A.
Hearing your stories, that is what's motivating. When we can see and hear and feel that there's another human who's experiencing this, we feel it deeply. And it's when we feel that's how we can take the best action.
For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis-St. Paul, online and archived at KFAI.org, the community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and 106.7 FM in St. Paul, streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Steve McKellistrom.
I'm Paul Van Dyke. Tonight on Right on Radio, we speak with Brandon Graham about his novels Good for Nothing and Missing People.
We then talk with Alex George about his new novel, Setting Free the Kites, a story of the complexities of adolescence. He is also an author of the best-selling novel, A Good American.
In the meantime, we've got Brandon Graham and Alex George, plus your What's Happening calendar of literary events. So stay tuned for Right on Radio.
All right, Brandon, you with us?
I'm here.
All right, great. Go ahead and do your first reading.
Okay, so this, just for a slight bit of context, this is from the first chapter of my first novel, Good for Nothing. It's the end of the chapter, and the chapter is called A Series of Rash Decisions. The he that we're going to start with is Flip Mellis, the protagonist. In the kitchen, he twists the lid off the whiskey and takes a long swig. The hard part is done. It's all downhill from here. The clock on the microwave reads 3:30. It had taken longer than he thought. There's no rushing perfection. He fills the paint tray, gets the roller ready, and starts rolling the walls. The saturated fibers of the roller pad make a wet whir, like surf slipping back into the sea. He's cold again. He turns the ceiling fan off and watches to see that the blades are actually slowing. Walks back and steps right in the middle of the full paint tray. He lifts his cold, slippery foot and dangles it over the drop cloth. Tendrils of flesh-toned paint create an instant action painting as he rattles his dripping foot on its swollen ankle. He loses his balance and steps right on the frantic design he just made, slides along in the paint slick. His other foot moves to keep him from falling and steps onto the paint roller. It shifts and crushes under his weight, pitching him gut first onto the paint tray. He lies there a long time with most of the air knocked out of him. He can smell the whiskey on his own stale breath as he exhales into the drop cloth. The paint tray has cut his side. He worries he's broken a rib. He gets up on all fours and looks under himself as the paint drools from his soft, sagging belly. His skin is pale and stark against the vivid pink smear. He backs himself onto his feet, and after two failed attempts, he stands. Cold paint slowly rolls over the front of his boxer shorts. This frustrates him. At least I won't have to sew them. The baseboard is splashed with pink. The rug is soaking up pink paint, and his torso is dripping paint onto the tops of his hairy toes and yellow toenails. It looks like the slaughter scene from a slasher film, only in anemic pastel tones. This is horrible. This was what he was afraid of. It's exactly why he'd avoided this job for weeks. Disaster is an inevitable outcome of everything he tries to do lately. I'm cursed. Flip reaches back to steady himself against the desk. His hand comes down on the round-bottomed Tupperware bowl. The bowl tips up and pours paint onto the top of Lynn's desk. Oh, no. He kneels where he is. His knees just give up, and he dry sobs into his hands for a long, long time, the edges of his bandaged hand leaving smears of paint along the stubble of his unshaven face. When Flip is bored with sobbing, he forms a new plan. First, he marches into the kitchen with his body still dripping paint and takes long pulls of whiskey. After a few minutes, he begins to feel courageous. He drains the bottle and throws it in the sink. He makes his way into the bathroom and washes down a bottle full of sleeping pills with Pepto-Bismol. It tastes worse than he imagined possible. He doesn't want that to be the last thing he ever tastes, so he goes to the freezer, digs around, and stands over the sink pounding down chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream with an oversized serving spoon as fast as he can. His stomach doesn't seem too happy about it. He pats his fat chest a few times and belches long and loud. He realizes he's drunk when he opens his mouth wide and pokes himself in the left eye with a spoonful of ice cream. He wipes off his eyelashes and keeps at it, one eye closed, because he likes to finish what he started. Eventually, he polishes it off and leaves the carton and the spoon in the sink. As he stumbles away, his belly smears paint along the edge of the counter and door jamb. In the office, he finds the belt of his robe and makes a noose in one end. It eats up over half the belt length, but it should still work. His paint-spattered toes find purchase on the middle shelf of a bookcase, and he teeters there drunkenly, periodically throwing out his arms for balance as he tries to loop the other end of the belt over the motor to the ceiling fan. When he's satisfied with his work, he sticks his head through the noose and tightens it. I'm ready, he tells himself. He doesn't know the proper protocol, but he assumes he should leave a note. He doesn't know what to say, and sorry is all that comes to his foggy brain. It would be a lot of effort to go and write a note that only says sorry. Is it really worth it? Can't I just blow it off? I'm beat. Finally, he realizes it will be inconsiderate to his family not to attempt to explain his actions. So he digs his finger into the knot and manages to loosen it. He loses his balance, and the bookcase, half full of self-help books, tumbles onto the floor where they join their beer-soaked brethren. He dangles there, looking up at the short piece of terry cloth toward the ceiling fan. He's shocked the fall hasn't broken his neck. In fact, it has made his neck feel better. Not a herniated disc after all. What a relief. He's surprised he can still breathe and that the tips of his toes just touch the floor, though his foot throbs from where the book crushed it. He worries at the way the fan is cocked sideways over his head. What if it falls and gives him a nasty concussion? Then he hears the garage door opening. His butt is cold. How embarrassing would it be for his family to find him hanging there, dead, with his boxer shorts ripped? He tries to reach around and close the gap in his shorts. The movement causes Flip to twist slowly, like a grotesque, sad hobo ballerina on point. And as he does, his eyes drift around the paint-drenched room, at the pink carpet and the baseboards, at the trail of spatters and footprints leading in and out of the room, and at the half-painted walls. House keys rattle, and voices of his bickering children come to him. He hears his mother-in-law's voice, too. He thinks of the whiskey bottle, the ice cream carton, and the stench of beer. As the door opens, his eyes finally rest on Lynn's desk and her Tupperware bowl. Oh, cuss, he says. He reflexively reaches to tighten the belt around his bare middle and realizes he's hanging from it by his neck. Oh, cuss, he says again. And then he tries as hard as he can to be dead. So that's the end of the first chapter.
All right, that was Brandon Graham reading from his novel, Good for Nothing. Brandon has studied all over the world, places like Budapest, Hungary, Dijon, France. Spent a summer as a barman in England. He's got a couple of books out that came out in January. How's it going today, Brandon?
It's going great.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Good for Nothing? I know you just read the passage, but kind of set it up for us.
Sure. The story starts about 8 months after Flip has lost his job. It's set during the recession. So it's about 2008, 2009. And he had a good job, was fired, and is pretty debilitated by the fact that he can't find work. He's been depressed, and he's been sort of self-medicating, mostly with food at this point, and has gained a lot of weight and doesn't feel good in his own body. And the finances have started to put a lot of pressure on his family. And he was given an ultimatum to do something useful around the house while his family was gone. And he ended up messing it up, and it sort of devastates him. So he does a bunch of – he makes a lot of really bad choices.
Yeah, it's – I thought the title was interesting, Good for Nothing, because I mean, just from the passage you had read, a lot of times you get the sense that Flip really is good for nothing, and that he feels that way. But, like, throughout the novel, you can see he's actually a really capable person. I mean, he was really capable in the corporate world. He was really, he was a marathon runner. And it just kind of shows just how low he's been brought by the situation he's been put in.
Yeah, you know, I kind of think of Flip as one of these characters, a generation of men that's maybe a little older than me that believe that their role in the family is only as a breadwinner, and they really haven't exercised many other of their skill sets in the family. And then finding that he's no longer a breadwinner, he doesn't know who he is or what his value is, and just feels completely lost and devastated by it.
Yeah, it seems almost like he's taking the recession, he's taking the downturn in the economy, like, personal throughout the book, almost like nobody else is affected by it but him.
Yeah, so the way this came about is actually I was in the graduate program at Columbia College Chicago in book arts, and I had made a bunch of short books that had visual narrative and that had a written narrative that that worked in combination. And I had written one called How to Gut a Fish, and I had written one called How to Tie a Tie. And I got the idea that I wanted to write one called How to Tie a Noose. And I had this image of a man building a scaffolding out of self-help books and trying to hang himself, and that somehow his family finding him dangling there over all these books that he had read over the years, trying to improve his place in the world. It felt like a real kind of Willie Loman, really sad sack moment. And that seemed like a perfect metaphor for how a lot of people were feeling during the recession. And so I kind of thought of him as a metaphor for what was going on with a lot of people.
Yeah. The content's definitely heavy, but there's a lot of laughs throughout the book. I'm a big fan of the show Louie on FX, and one of the things about it is where, like, it's a tragedy, but it's presented as like a comedy, where, like, it's like the uncomfortable situations and the kind of the misery of the protagonist is almost like we're laughing at him. And it kind of comes across that way in this book, where it's really sad, but at the same time, you can't help but laugh at a lot of the situations Flip gets himself in.
Well, you know, when you're writing a book about someone that is depressed and obese and suicidal, you got to figure out a way to do it in a way that's entertaining enough for people to keep reading. And so that was a challenge. It's interesting when we play the who would play this role if it were a movie game. My wife is convinced that Louis C.K. is the right person to play Flip. So it's interesting that you mentioned Louis.
Perfect. And I have to say, sometimes Flip's not the most sympathetic protagonist. He does a lot of things throughout where I definitely, like, I mean, at one point he shoplifts a belt from a store because he wants to save, like, $8. And he doors a cop car just because he's angry. Where, like, you definitely kind of have, like, a mixed sense of, like, I kind of want him to get his, but at the same time I find myself rooting for him. Do you find that was, like, a hard balance to hold?
Yeah, I think it's funny. First of all, because of my background in visual arts, I have a kind of romance with subversive kinds of content. And so I really like the idea of creating a character, a main character, that was pretty hard to like. And the challenge was, how do I make people feel sympathetic enough for him so that they pull for him despite all the pretty disgusting, gross out kind of body stuff that goes on and a lot of the poor decisions that he makes. I do think, too, my love for Coen Brothers films and their kind of anti-hero protagonists probably played a part in how I came to write Flip.
Yeah. Do you want to read your passage from Missing People?
Yeah, sure. This takes place on a metro train from the western suburbs of Chicago into the city. And the character Towns Messenger is sitting up on the top deck and looking down and observing some behaviors that are starting to concern him. The girl's earmuffs roll into the aisle as the train slows for another stop. Army coat pulls his scarf up and wraps it around his neck a few times. He scoops the muffs and waggles them so the girl can see. When he's got her attention, he takes a few steps toward the vestibule. Towns can't understand what Army coat is doing, taunting the girl by taking her earmuffs, luring her to follow. He knows deep down Army coat plans to take the little girl. The grandmother will wake up with no granddaughter and no idea what happened. For all practical purposes, she will vanish like wood smoke on a stiff breeze. Army coat wiggles the muffs, grins bad teeth at the girl, and cocks his head toward the vestibule while taking a couple more steps. Towns looks to the other passengers, all lost in conversation, staring out the windows, reading the Sun-Times or staring at their phones. No one sees the girl slip off of her bench and shuffle her boots, her loose buckle slapping toward Army coat. Towns stands, leaving his bag unattended, and brushes past Stoddard, stepping on the tail of his yellow coat in passing. Army coat catches the movement and stretches the earmuffs over his own greasy head, smiles again to the girl like they're playing a game, starts walking to the doors. The woman exits the bathroom with a loud thwack of the heavy sliding door and waits for Army coat to pass. Towns thinks, this is it. Either she helps the little girl back to her grandmother, or I have to do something. I have no choice. The thought makes him sick. He takes little sips of air and watches the scene unfold, keeping pace with the girl below. The alcohol is making his forehead perspire, his armpits slick. The woman walks to the girl. They sidestep one another, and the woman heads back to her seat, placing her hands on each seat back to steady herself as the train breaks. Towns can hear Army coat kick the vestibule door to open it, sees the girl as she surges forward. He takes the narrow stairs, sticks his hands between the doors before they can close, and wedges his body through. The air between the cars is cold and close, shut off from the passengers, and eerily isolated. Mr. Stephanopoulos is still on the steps, his massive round form blocking half the steps. Army coat stands on the remaining bottom step with his back to the train exit, ready to leap off when the doors come open. He's taken the muffs from his head and holds them out, arm half bent, so the girl has to get closer. The girl edges up, hand outstretched to grab the offered earmuffs. The train stops at the platform. Town lets his body lurch forward and step between the girl and army coat. The doors open. Town yanks the muffs from the guy's dirty fingers and pitches them behind him, half leaping down the steps as army coat turns to leave. Not intending to tackle the man, not knowing what exactly he intends, they land in a tangle on the cement. "The heck's your problem?" the guy says, and strips Towns off as he stands. Towns gets to his feet, and before he can straighten, he's laid out like a corpse in a casket. He never saw the blow, not sure what hit him. Probably a fist, but it felt harder. The pain is unique to Towns' previous experience with being punched, immediate and bright and completely overwhelming. Splinters of light stab his eyes. A voice calls to him amid the sprays of sparks. I'll settle up with you someday, pretty boy. I'll take this out of your hide. Heavy feet run sloppily away. When he uncurls, he finds the poorly tailored ticket taker staring at him from the train door. Mr. Stephanopoulos is on his feet, in some pain with the effort, but using his bulk to hold the door until Towns can stagger back on board. Behind them, the grandmother has hoisted her grandbaby onto her shoulder and looks confused and something else, perhaps grateful. A Metro police officer dressed in tactical black, topped with a bulletproof vest, enters the vestibule and Towns tries to get his legs moving. The officer speaks into a mic at his shoulder and moves down the steps toward Towns. Towns tastes salt. When he runs his fingers around his gums, they come away bloody. No passengers exit the train. Everyone is waiting for him. He stumbles farther away and looks over the rail to the neighborhood below. He sees army coat making fresh tracks through a deep snow covering an abandoned lot. He lets the officer lead him back to the train.
All right, that was Brandon Graham reading from his new novel, Missing People. Brandon, that one thing with Towns, he's a really subdued guy. He's really passive. He's really into mindfulness and things like that. And this is the first scene where he really goes outside of the character we're first presented with.
Yeah, you know, the very first chapter is a Towns chapter, and it's slow. It's placid and calm compared to a lot of what follows in the book. But the notion was to show that he had really worked hard after the disappearance of his sister to kind of create a hermetic, calm existence. It's his strategy for dealing with the absence of Etta 6 years earlier.
Yeah, and this book takes place, it's on the six-year anniversary of, it'd be Towns' sister's disappearance. And it seems like a lot of that, the old stuff that maybe they'd buried away really starts to come to the surface.
Yeah, for sure. I have this, I have a sort of ridiculous metaphor that I like to use about the things that interest me related to characters. And I call it the Dairy Queen dip cone theory of character development. Essentially, it means that we like to present a kind of hard, smooth, glossy surface to the world. That's the kind of narrative that we like to tell the world. And then things come along and crack that shell open, and all of our gooey messiness on the inside come out. And I'm interested in the story that we like to tell the world, the kind of elaborate constructions that people make in order to function, the things that specifically break that for the characters, and then how much resilience they have, how much capacity they have for putting their lives back together or not. So, the absence of Etta struck all the major characters in the movie in a different way,
Getting ahead of yourself.
Oh, sorry, what?
Getting ahead of yourself with that movie talk.
Right. Yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself. they all came up with strategies for how to deal with the absence of Etta, and it pulled the family apart, incidents that occur like this for towns and other incidents on the six-year anniversary kind of bring everything back up, and it shows how sort of fragile the world that they've created for themselves really is.
Yeah, and so there's four characters that get followed. It's Towns, the brother, and then Etta's mom, Etta's dad, and Etta's boyfriend at the time of her disappearance. And it really seems like all of the characters have just been stuck in a lot of ways. I mean, they've gone on and done other things, but that their lives really haven't moved forward in any sort of a positive direction.
Yeah. For instance, Newton, Etta's boyfriend, it's kind of interesting how I came up with him, but essentially I thought he was kind of a fun plot device. I could drop him into any scene and he would be sort of an angry young man that would do something, just to drive the action forward. And I wasn't really wild about him. You know, he's kind of homophobic and he likes to pick fights and he's a drunk and he's mean. And as the writing went on, I came to really, really, really like him a lot.
So, yeah, there's a lot beneath the surface with him. And, you know, he's an Afghan vet and he had lost a leg and he had lost one of his friends over there. And so it's just like another major loss that is kind of buried underneath within the Dairy Queen dip cone of his life, I guess you would say.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the title Missing People, it does refer to Etta, but it also refers to each character and the loss that they're experiencing in different ways, and also their desire to have Etta back in their lives in some way.
Yeah. The tone in your two books are really different. Like, how'd you prepare for writing a book like Missing People as compared to like writing a book like Good for Nothing?
It is sort of interesting. I think that Good for Nothing is kind of a standalone in a way. I knew that the topic was pretty depressing, and I started writing it. And then once I wrote the first chapter, I was like, okay, this is an interesting voice, and I'm just going to push forward and make it work the whole way through. Missing People is much more like most of my short fiction. The tone is more similar to my short fiction. But, you know, I think that they do deal with the same kinds of characters in a lot of ways. The big difference is that the kind of satirical tone in Good for Nothing is a little unique.
All right, Brandon, we're out of time, unfortunately. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Brandon Graham.
You bet.
Author of Good for Nothing and Missing People. Thanks for coming on, Brandon.
Thanks, Paul.
Programming on KFAI is supported by the Masonic Cancer Center, University of Minnesota. The Masonic Cancer Center works to reduce the burden of cancer on everyone who calls Minnesota home by relentlessly pursuing deeper understandings of the causes, prevention, detection, and treatment of cancer, and improving quality of life for cancer survivors and their caregivers. Learn more about cancer prevention and care resources by joining the monthly Fireside Chat virtual series, where you can get cancer and health-related information straight from the experts in an easy-to-understand format. For more information, visit cancer.umn.edu.
Join KFAI for the 21st Annual Balkanikos Concert. Artsy and avant-garde, emotional, upbeat, and irregular. And at the end of it, meet performers and fellow music lovers over a tasty Balkan reception. Featuring three female composers from Bulgaria, Serbia, and Turkey. And, as always, Balkanikos will premiere a few pieces new to the world. Saturday, April 12th at 7 p.m. at Alton Recital Hall on the U of M West Bank campus. Free and open to the public, and the facilities accommodate persons with disabilities. All are welcome. If you have never experienced this music before, don't miss it.
Visit kfai.org/Balkan for more details.
From Memorial Day to Labor Day, the elaborately filigreed gates of Funnelot opened to welcome visitors who had had their fill of the natural glories that Maine had to offer and were looking for some man-made entertainment. And what entertainment it was. At Funnelot, a person could step back in time to the days of Arthurian legend. The court of Camelot had been recreated on the coast of southern Maine, Old England and New England, as the legend above the gates put it. Teenage knights clanked about in ill-fitting plastic armor, and damsels swept up and down the pathways in bodices garlanded with ribbons. There were jousting contests every afternoon. Park employees mounted two tiny Shetland ponies and charged gently at each other, wielding plastic lancets for the edification of the watching crowds. All the traditional amusement park entertainments were on offer as well. There were devices designed to make visitors lose their lunch by sending them rocketing skyward or plunging towards the earth at unnatural velocities and angles. There was a tilt-a-whirl, bumper cars, and a large Ferris wheel. A roller coaster built on an elaborate scaffold of cross-hatched wood soared over the other attractions. The excited screams of the riders could be heard throughout the park. All park employees wore medieval costumes and were required to talk in English accents and address guests using antiquated terms of phrase. The air was ripe with Verilese sires and prithee fair maidens. My father insisted on teaching all new recruits this mangled argo himself. His own English accent was a hybrid of Down East Maine and faux Cockney. It made Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins sound like Laurence Olivier. In a way, it was perfect, this mauling of the English language. From the logo of the local dentist that was emblazoned in the center of every knight's shield to the faded pennants that flew from the molded plastic turrets, the whole place was a riot of artificiality, a festival of cheese. But authenticity was never really the point. When I was younger, my father had bought a miniature golf course from an amusement park that was going out of business in Oklahoma. He had shipped the whole thing halfway across the country on two giant trucks and rebuilt it hole for hole. Unfortunately, the park in Oklahoma had had a Wild West theme, and consequently the golf course was decorated with cacti and teepees and gin joints in dusty border towns rather than castles in the English countryside. Every winter, my father promised himself that he would turn all the gunslinging cowboys into wizards and court jesters and the squaws into medieval maidens, but he never had the time. And so the cowboys and Indians remained amid the tranquility of Arthurian England, rifles drawn and tomahawks raised, like a weird glitch in the space-time continuum.
Very good. You've been listening to Alex George reading from his new novel, Setting Free the Kites, a story of the complexities of adolescence. He is also the author of the best-selling novel, A Good American. Alex George, welcome to Right on Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the Funnelot Amusement Park, because it plays a relatively large role in the course of the story. What was it about that drew you to putting that in as a plot element?
Well, improbable as though this seems, when I first arrived in the United States, one of the first jobs that I had was running the largest outdoor water park in central Missouri, down at the Lake of the Ozarks. So I actually have quite a lot of firsthand experience of that world. And so a lot of the things that I wrote about come from that. And in particular, one of the first things that I did when I arrived at the water park was to commission an artist to design a mascot for us. And it was a smiling cartoon shark. And then we had the shark made into a costume. Mm. At some point during the process, I got a phone call, and it was the company making the costume, and they said, Mr. George, how tall is the person who's going to be wearing this costume going to be? And without really thinking about it too hard, I said, well, I suppose about average height, which in retrospect was a woeful miscalculation on my part, because the only other two employees who worked full-time in the off-season were both over 6 foot tall, and I am not over 6 foot tall. You can, if you turn on the television in mid-Missouri in the summertime, you can still see there are TV ads that are still running for this park that feature this adorable furry shark dancing by the side of a wave pool. And that's me. Mm. I'm the guy in the shark suit. And it was all rather undignified, but I consoled myself at the time by telling myself, well, this is all material, and one day I will put this in a book. And this, Setting Free the Kites, is that book.
That's fabulous. That's a great story. We should probably back up a little bit, too, and tell our listeners a little bit about the story without giving too much away, of course, but just sort of give us an idea of what it is, sort of a coming-of-age story, isn't it?
Sure, it is. It's a coming-of-age story, and the novel tells the story of the friendship of two boys, Robert and Nathan. It's set in Maine in the mid-1970s, and it's set over the course of about two summers. It looks at their friendship and how it develops over time and the legacy of that friendship moving forward.
And they're quite different, aren't they? Robert is quite reserved and cautious, and Nathan is much more outgoing and risk-taking.
That's exactly right. Yes, they're very different. They're very different. You're right. Robert is the narrator of the book, and so he is by nature, I suppose, the more of an observer than a doer. Whereas Nathan is this sort of force of nature who sort of drags Robert with him on his various adventures. And as Robert says at one point, Nathan knew no fear, only hope.
Mm. And how did they meet? Let's talk a little bit about that.
So they meet on the first day of eighth grade, and Robert has been bullied for some time in a sort of systemic way by another boy at the school. And he has spent his summer dreading going back to school precisely because he doesn't want to run into this other boy anymore. And sure enough, on the first day, it all begins again. And Nathan, however, just happens to come across them, and even though he is far, far smaller than the bully, he jumps in without really thinking about it and rescues Robert. And that is how they meet, and that's sort of the genesis of it all and the engine that drives a lot of what goes forward from there.
Yeah, that sort of defines in many ways not only their personalities, but how it is that they are going to come out with this great friendship as a result of the incident.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the setting, too, the overall setting. I mean, Funnelodd is one of the settings, but more generally, you set it in Maine, and you're a Brit from your accent, obviously, and you're living in Missouri currently. So what was it about Maine that drove you to choose that?
So the climactic scene of the book, when I first imagined it, took place on a lighthouse. And so because of that, I had always imagined that it would be that the story would take place somewhere in New England. And originally, in fact, I had thought that it would take place in Rhode Island until I realized that wasn't very sensible because I know nothing about Rhode Island. but I do know a lot about Maine. I mean, I've been going there for years. I have friends who live there. My wife actually went to school there. So it's a place that I know well. And so I basically took the action and then moved it up the coast to Maine. And in fact, in the final version of the story, the lighthouse has vanished and is replaced by another kind of a building. But I kept it in Maine anyway. And one of the reasons for that is because, as I said, I do love it. And I think that when you write about a place that you love, it helps. It shows in the writing. And hopefully a little bit of the passion that I have for the place comes through in the language.
Yeah, it very much does. I really got the sense that I was there, and I've never actually been to Maine, but in many ways it's like Minnesota because it's got this huge forested area covering part of it,
right.
And there's this northern climate to it, which is similar to what we have. And I guess one of the differences, the biggest difference would be that, you know, we're completely landlocked, except for Lake Superior,
right.
And that's on the ocean, so there's a difference there.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about the two boys again and the relationship that they have with Robert's brother, who has muscular dystrophy.
Right. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about in this book and what I wanted to examine was loss and how different people respond to it, and more importantly, how people find their way out of the darkness that that can cause and back into the light again. And so Liam, Robert's brother, is 4 years older than Robert, and he had been diagnosed with this disease before Robert was even born. And one of the things that that meant was that Robert has spent his entire life under the shadow of his brother's illness and knowing that his brother is going to die an early and awful death. And one of the things that interested me was looking at, well, what does that do to a person? And one of the consequences of Liam's illness is that Robert has always, to a degree, been has played second fiddle, mm-hmm. both to Liam and to his illness, in the eyes of his parents, and he often feels rather ignored and marginalised, which I think makes an important component of the boy that he has become.
Right.
And so it was interesting to me to look at all of that. And Liam is a character who effectively refuses to acknowledge that how ill he is, and that was kind of fun to write as well. And he actually puts his parents through all sorts of additional pain because he insists on going through with college applications and things like that, even though everybody knows that most likely he's not going to be well enough ever to go. I first became aware of muscular dystrophy. I read an essay by a writer called Penny Wolfson, which is in one of those Best American Essay collections, I think in about 2002. And she was writing about her son who had muscular dystrophy. And it just, I kept going back to this essay. And then I learned that the essay had been extracted from a book. So I found the book. Mm. And then I read another book on it, another memoir, and then some textbooks as well. And it just, I couldn't get it out of my head. I mean, it's a truly awful, awful disease. Mm-hmm. There is no cure. And it only affects the young, and very few sufferers make it to their 20th birthday. And what's particularly terrible about it is that it manifests itself in a very physical way, because there is this scoliosis of the spine, so that the sufferers actually literally warp as they get older. And one of the things that I kept thinking about, I'm the father of two children, mm-hmm. was what it must be like as a parent to watch your child go through that. And, as writers, we're always looking for the next thing to write about and casting around for ideas. And sometimes they fall into your lap. And this one would not let me go. It mm-hmm. just grabbed me. And so it was very much a question of, well, that's a clue.
Yeah.
when something really affects you that badly, you need to write about it.
Right.
And so I did.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes characters will grab authors, and sometimes a situation like this. I was talking to a writer relatively recently that intended to include a character as just a minor part of the book, and the character appears in the first chapter, and the character kept calling to him, saying, no, I need more. I need more space here. I need more room to develop and to blossom and to show you that I'm interesting. And so he had to sort of change the book. And this one seems like it's more of a genesis that came about almost before you started writing, of this is something that needs to be told.
It really was in this particular instance. But no, I do know. I mean, characters do have this annoying habit of not behaving the way that they're supposed to. And they do. They call out and they yell and they make a ruckus. And you kind of have to, you can't sort of put them in the back and ignore them. You have to pay attention.
Yeah. And I love the fact that although Robert loves Liam, there is this sort of resentment that has built up over time. And then Nathan comes along and bonds with Liam really, really well, and sort of subconsciously, I suppose, gets Robert to sort of rethink things. And you don't emphasize this, but that's just the impression I got from reading it, is that the appearance of Nathan really helped Robert to appreciate just what he had in his brother, what he has in his brother.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that that's always the case, isn't it? When you introduce a third party into what was previously a sort of binary relationship, then it sheds light on all aspects of it. And I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, to be honest with you, but that makes complete sense. And I think that's right. I think that, I mean, that, but there was also a kind of a, you know, the I talked before about how Robert always feels that he's in his brother's shadow. And I think that there was an echo of that in the way that Nathan came in, and Nathan bonded with Liam in a way that Robert had never really been able to, particularly about the music that they listened to. And I think that there was certainly a little jealousy might be too strong a word, but you know, there's a degree of resentment or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but that's very much Robert's way. I mean, he's very passive and reactive. And, you know, only when he sees Nathan come in, he goes, wow, you know, he's met him once or twice. I've known him my whole life, and it seems that they've created this bond.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I suppose what that does is it showed Robert the possibilities that lay there.
Yeah, right. Well, let's listen, if we can, to another section from the book.
Sure. So this section explains a little bit about the title, Setting Free the Kites, and it takes place very early on, just after after Nathan's father's funeral.
Okay.
Nathan led me to a wooden shed that stood behind the house. He pulled back the latch and ushered me inside. There were two large windows, one looking toward the house and the other toward the ocean. The walls, floor, and ceiling had all been painted dazzling white. There was a long table in the middle of the room. Forests of color-flecked paintbrushes stood in grimy glass jars. There were hacksaws of various sizes, hammers, pliers, spools of thread, and a regiment of glue pots. A heavy iron vise was fixed to the edge of the table. From its grip, emerged a complicated three-dimensional matrix of pale balsa wood rods. But it was the display on the walls that really caught my attention. Kites were mounted in neatly ordered rows. There were squares, rectangles, and fat diamonds of tautly drawn fabric, a glorious riot of color. This is my father's workshop, said Nathan. I looked around the room at the kites. He made these? Nathan nodded. Pick one, he said. We'll take it out to the beach and fly it. Really? He didn't make them to hang on a wall, Robert. I pointed to an orange lozenge with flashes of bright yellow jagging diagonally between its corners. That one. The moment we stepped outside, the fabric began to billow and snap in the breeze. Nathan steadied himself as the kite came to life in his hands. Just beyond the workshop was a weathered wooden staircase leading to the beach. I followed Nathan down the steps. The beach was in fact a cove cut off at both ends by jagged promontories of rock. Dad and I came down here to fly kites, shouted Nathan above the wind. At the ocean's edge, he threaded the white line through the tiny metal eye in the center of the kite's frame, and then he handed the spool back to me. I began to run along the sand, lifting the line high above my head, tugging it upward as I went. The kite caught a gust of wind and streaked into the sky. I allowed the nylon to unspool quickly, giving the greedy winds what they wanted. Nathan joined me at the water's edge. We watched the kite bob and weave above us. I could feel the tug of every gust of wind in my fingers. I lost track of time then. There was nothing except the kite and me and the thin cord that connected us. At some point, Nathan stepped forward and took the line from me. I surrendered without protest, but did not take my eyes off the kite. We stood side by side, hypnotized by its gentle dance. Neither of us said a word. And then, without warning, Nathan reached into his pocket and pulled out a penknife. Before I knew what was happening, with one quick motion, he cut through the line. The kite spiraled upward until it vanished into the clouds. What did you do that for? I demanded. My dad wouldn't have wanted his kites trapped in that workshop. Nathan smiled at me sadly. He may be buried in the ground, but I can still set his kites free.
Very good. That is Alex George reading from his new novel, Setting Free the Kites. And you're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI. That was a very powerful scene, and followed by a very powerful scene where Nathan's father dies unexpectedly, tragically, very early in the book. And it's sort of... It does. It was interesting. I was thinking about the whole notion of kites and setting them free. And it is interesting that kites are this sort of free-flying thing, and yet they aren't, because they're always tethered by that string. And they're always tethered. Yeah. And then in this case, Nathan decides we're going to just completely let them go.
Right, right. And I think that it's a good metaphor for his approach to life generally. You know, one of the, he's always trying to escape his earthbound existence. And this is one of the ways that sort of manifests itself. There's a freedom to his spirit, which I found terribly appealing when I was writing him. And cutting that line and letting those kites soar really sort of spoke to me.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about, we'll talk a little bit more later about other things if we have time, but the scene where Nathan's father dies very early in the book, so I'm not giving anything away here, and it has the potential to be written in an extremely tragic way or a somewhat comical way, and you decide to sort of blend it into the sort of tragic comic telling. Talk a little bit about your decision to write it that way, so that we get elements of humor from it, and at the same time this awful thing is going on and we don't know whether to laugh or cry.
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I made a conscious decision to tell it one way or the other. I mean, it's so inherently shocking what happens that to my mind, I suppose it was almost the tone of the thing almost didn't matter because of the substance of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So,
you know, whether you tell it in a jokey way or a serious way, you know, Nathan's father still falls off the ceiling and off the roof, and he still dies. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I worked very hard at that scene. It took a lot of rewriting to get it right. But that, I think, was more to do, now that I think about it, with pace than voice, because it's the sort of thing that, if allowed to go on too long, could get, I think, a little cumbersome. I don't know. I guess there are a couple of humorous elements to it, but not really.
I just didn't really mean it was funny from that standpoint, but just the absurdity and the oddness of it was
right.
So shocking. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's certainly odd and it's certainly shocking. It's interesting because originally in an earlier draft of the novel, that scene was the first scene in the book.
Mm.
And my editor said to me, I'm not sure you can do this. He said, I think, and it wasn't so much that we were going to put people off, but it was more just the fact that the reader didn't know who this person was.
Right.
And so I wrote some additional scenes, so we actually got a sense of who Nathan's father was before he died.
Yeah.
So we were able to miss him.
Yeah, it gives a greater
impact.
In a way
that we wouldn't have been. Right, right. Yeah. And also it explains more about the legacy that he left.
Yeah.
You know, when this happened to Nathan. And so that was interesting. But it is a scene that, you know, a lot of people have commented on and have been shocked by. But that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a fabulous scene.
Always happy to shock people.
Yeah. You want to draw them in, and that's what it does. So we're going to have to leave it at that because we're out of time. But a fabulous book, fabulous conversation here. This is Steve McElstrom speaking with Alex George about his new novel, Setting Free the Kites. Alex George, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Thank you, Steve.
And now this.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to Right on Radio. I'm Steve McElstrom.
I'm Paul Van Dyke. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Brandon Graham and Alex George. Don't forget to tune in next week when we'll have another great show lined up for you.
And I'm Liz Olds. You're listening to KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis, and on the web at kfai.org. Now stay tuned for Bonjour in Minnesota.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. And her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friends are nowhere to be seen, and she walks through a sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view. And she's hooked to the silver screen, but the film is a saddening bore, 'cause she's lived it 10 times or more. It's about to be lived again, as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Look at those cavemen go. It's a freaky show. Take a look at that low man beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know. He's in the best-selling show. Is there life on? Have struck for fine, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hearts, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broad. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog, and clown. But the film is a saddening bore, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be lived again, as I ask you to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. In the best selling show, take a look at that. Best-selling show. Who's the liar?